welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Cloti in Washington, D.C.
We very much welcome the recent decision of the United States of America to impose sanctions on rebel actors. This is something that comes 2 weeks after the UN group of experts released its report.
The foreign minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo welcomes U.S. sanctions on three rebels.
We found that amongst all Kenyans, 81% support the Gen Z movement that is seeking various reforms for Kenya. 81% is overwhelmingly high.
A new poll shows overwhelming public support for the Kenyan Gen Z protests.
We are women who have been privileged to have education. We have been privileged to have training. And what we want to do is to give back to our community so that more girls can do what we have done and even better.
And in Cameroon, former student of Seka Baptist College, an all-female boarding secondary school, plan to hold a four-day convention beginning August 1st in Chicago. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The foreign minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, has welcomed sanctions imposed by the U.S. government on three rebels. Therese Kayikwamba Wagner also says that the international community should go a step further to impose sanctions on those who support the M23 rebels. She says the attacks continue to maim, kill and displace thousands of unarmed women and children in the eastern part of the country. Her remarks come after the U.S. imposed sanctions on Corneille Nangaa, the leader of the Congo River Alliance, Bertrand Bisimwa, the head of the M23, and Charles Samatama, deputy military leader of the Tiwanejo rebel group. They are accused of causing instability, conflict and civilian displacement in the DRC. Foreign Minister Therese Kayikwamba Wagner spoke with me in an exclusive video link. She tells me that the government in Kinshasa is committed to bringing peace to the country's east.
We very much welcome the recent decision of the United States of America to impose sanctions on rebel actors. This is something that comes 2 weeks after the UN group of experts released its report, a very damning report on the presence of over 4,000 Rwandan troops in our country, 4,000 troops we have not invited. And so it is an important first step. However, we think more has to be done, again, in light of the drastic humanitarian situation of over 7 million displaced Congolese citizens.
You were quoted as saying that you intend to bring more proactive diplomacy to resolving some of these conflicts or to bring peace in the DRC. What do you mean by that?
I think we have made very sustained and very laudable efforts in our diplomacy since President Tshisekedi took the reins of the country. I see myself in the continuation of this, and I see myself in pushing further the envelope on certain issues. When I talk about being more proactive in our diplomacy, it's also bringing our stories closer to our different partners, to our different stakeholders that we engage on so many other issues. So this is one of the key elements. Being proactive also means sometimes starting difficult conversations. And I think this is one of the difficult conversations a lot of our partners and stakeholders have been shying away from. The fact that we have a neighboring country that in other countries is welcomed as a peace bringer, as a peacemaker, but is a warmonger in the Great Lakes region. It is a difficult conversation to have, but that's what it's about when you talk about proactive diplomacy. It's bringing also these issues to the table. And this is what I see as one of the key tenets of my vision and in my tenure.
Your government has called on the international community to put pressure on countries who are supporting the M23 rebels as part of the effort to bring peace to your countries, to the eastern part of your country. Talk to me about what the expectations of your government is regarding this.
Again, I know that there are a lot of, you know, divergent views on the situation in the DRC. So I want to bring us back to something that we can all consider as objective, the last report of the group of experts, reiterating what we have said for a very long time, the presence of Rwandan Defense Forces on our national territory, uninvited, unsolicited, and in flagrant violation of all international humanitarian and other aspects of international law. So this is what we talk about when we want more from the international community. It is defending this, the standards that we have all adhered to. It is also upholding these values that we defend on other fronts and the necessity to do that in the DRC, where we have 7 million displaced persons and we have thousands of people that have been killed since the beginning of this conflict. It's very important here to bring back also attention on the fact that in the beginning, this was presented as the M23 returning after 10 years. I will just tell you as, you know, a small bracket. 10 years ago, I was a humanitarian worker in North Kivu. I witnessed the plight, the suffering brought upon the Congolese population by the M23. 10 years later, we are again in that situation. And 10 years later, it is the same thing. It's a so-called M23 backed by Rwanda. And now we have even more Rwandan troops than M23 soldiers. So we have a big issue here when we talk about this problematic as if it were a singular issue, whereas it is a threat to international peace and security. And we want and we expect the international community, which is not only Western countries, it also includes our neighbors, our African brothers, our African institutions. We want the international community to hold the commandeers of this campaign of pain, of suffering, of displacement accountable for what they're doing to us.
Talking about dialogue, is the administration in Kinshasa, your administration, willing to sit down at the top level with your neighboring countries, including Zambia, Uganda, and Rwanda, to help resolve this problem of this M23 rebellion or conflict in the eastern part of the country?
I want to remind you that we have a Luanda, the Luanda process that has been established as a diplomatic forum in which this issue, precisely this issue, is being discussed. And we still adhere to it. Why do we adhere to it? Even if the flagrant violation of our territorial integrity, even if there are 4,000 Rwandan troops on our territory and over 7 million IDPs, we want a durable solution. This is why we go back to Luanda, because we are the ones who are burying our mothers, our brothers, our sisters, our fathers with this war. We want an end to it. It's been 30 years, and each year has been 1 year too much. So we are committed to finding a sustainable solution. The question that I want to ask you is if the other stakeholders are also committed to peace.
Therese Kayikwamba Wagner is Foreign Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. She spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa. The Rwandan government sharply denies accusations that it supports the M23 rebels. Months ago, the authorities in Rwanda rejected U.S. calls for the withdrawal of troops and missile systems from eastern Congo, saying they are defending Rwandan territory as Congo carries out a, quote, dramatic military buildup near the border. Rwanda's foreign ministry in a statement spoke of threats to Rwandan national security stemming from the presence in Congo of an armed group whose members include alleged perpetrators of the 1994 genocide. In Kenya, a newly released poll shows overwhelming public support for the Gen Z protests. It showed that at least 81% of Kenyans back the movement. The findings come as protesters demand reforms in major areas including taxation, corruption, government excess, the escalating cost of living, economic hardship, unemployment, and poor political and fiscal leadership. Conducted by the marketing firm Tifa, the findings show responses to questions such as support for the Gen Z movement, demands by protesters and support for the dismissal of the cabinet, as well as the actions of police officers. For more details about the research findings, I spoke to Maggie Ireri. She is the CEO of Tifa Research Company.
So when we did the study last week, we found that amongst all Kenyans, 81% support the Gen Z movement that is seeking various reforms for Kenya. 81% is overwhelmingly high. And if you compare the young people vis-a-vis the older age group, we find that the percentages in terms of support is very similar. So what you can see, there's an overwhelming support for the Gen Z movement and the protests that they're engaging in. What we did is that we then analyzed whether they support the movement or the protest by A, based on the political party affiliation. So what we did is we asked them, in the last election, who did you vote for? So we had the people who voted for the current government, and they're the people who are opposition. So we're finding the people who voted the current government in, 79% support the Gen Z movement as compared to 91% of those who voted for the opposition. I know 79% is slightly lower, but 79% of your voters, of the present voters, support the Gen Z movement. That's pretty high. And you can see that this particular issue is broad-based, and the issues that are being raised by the Gen Z have nationwide appeal and political party appeal.
Talk to me about police actions during the Gen Z protests, because a series of allegations have been raised against some police officers who they accuse of using excessive force.
Of course, the police has been called in to manage protesters, but what we're finding out is 75% of Kenyans feel that the police is using excessive force. And these sentiments are very high in Nairobi, very high in Nairobi, with over 90% of residents of Nairobi saying that the police is using excessive force. Of course, you're aware that Nairobi has been the hub of a lot of these protests, and the police in Nairobi are seen to be using excessive force. And if you remember what happened in Kenya, the first death was actually recorded in Nairobi, where there was Rex Masai who died. And then there was also some issues that happened in Githurai, which is a suburb within Nairobi, where the protesters were apparently shot and killed.
What about the findings about cabinet resolution? Because the protest and the pressure associated with it, we understand, led President Ruto to dissolve the cabinet and reconstitute it.
So when the Gen Z protesters were advocating for reforms in the country, they were saying that President Ruto must fire all cabinet secretaries. And when we, at the point where we did this study, Ruto had fired all the cabinet secretaries, and we found that 67% strongly supported the move to dissolve the cabinet.
What about the opinion on the fate of the cabinet secretaries?
So at that point, again, 53% of Kenyans felt that none of the cabinet secretaries should be retained, whereas 38% felt that the few good cabinet secretaries should be retained. Now, for those who say that a few should be retained, we then asked them which cabinet secretaries should be reappointed. And what we found out in terms of the top three was the cabinet secretary for Interior, that's Kithure Kindiki, had a 61% mention. Then we had Eliud Owalo of the ICT and Digital Economy, 48%. And then we had Ezekiel Machogu, 23%. And he was the cabinet secretary for education. So the Kenyans were pushing for this cabinet secretary to be reappointed. However, if you look at what happened yesterday and last week, the cabinet secretary who's been reappointed out of this list was Kindiki Kibure, who's the one for Interior, but Eliud Owalo, Ezekiel Machogu, who were number two and number three respectively, were not reappointed.
Overall, what was the major takeaway of this findings?
I know there's been a lot of conversation, especially amongst the private sector companies, saying that the protests are resulting to loss in business, property damage. That has been the conversation that has been running amongst the private sector. But when you talk to the ordinary Kenyans, and most of them are either unemployed or they are low-income earners, and they're experiencing the high cost of living, most of them support the protest.
Maggie Ireri is the CEO of Tifa Research Company. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Amid the climate crisis, women in some African countries often find themselves left behind by their husbands who migrate far away for work. These abandoned women say they struggle to feed their children and some never see their husbands again. On the next edition of Our Voices, we'll take a closer look at climate widows and how they are combating and surviving the environmental crisis and the impacts on their lives. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
In the Gambia, a parliamentarian says proponents of religious and traditional beliefs are not deterred by the decision to reject a measure to repeal the ban on female genital mutilation, or FGM. Almami Giba, who led the push in parliament, says a majority of the people of the Gambia will not allow a few propagandists to impose a Western way of life on them. His remarks come after parliament voted to reject the bill that sought to repeal a 2015 law prohibiting the procedure. The law criminalizes FGM, which is widely practiced in the Gambia. Islamic scholars and some lawmakers campaign for the law's repeal. They contend that it undermines the cultural and religious rights of the Gambians. Parliamentarian Amami Giba tells me that the lawmakers will continue the fight to repeal the ban.
The bill that I want to repeal in parliament is entitled Prohibition of Female Circumcision. We don't want to take the notion of the Western propagandists and the activists that are vested into the connotation of FGM. FGM is a money-making venture. The reason why I say so, I am the one who had worked towards repealing this bill. I did the bill on my own accord, you know, where brought it to the parliament, and it's the parliament that supported me in the gazetting. This is a law that is supposedly done by 75 to 80% of Gambians. The fear of Westerners cutting aid, that is the sole issue why this bill failed. But I'm telling you, it is a higher percentage in the Gambia that supported, that is asking for the repeal of this bill called female circumcision.
Imami, the question people are asking is, female circumcision has very negative health impact on women, especially childbirth and female health. And that is why a lot of people are against it around the world. So why do you think this is just a propaganda thing?
The negativity is all cooked by the Western propagandists. I can tell you, I'm a Gambian. In the Gambian context, Peter, I can tell you, there is no empirical evidence showing for performing female circumcision, women XYZ have died. No statistics. For performing female circumcision in the hospital, we have major hospitals, RVTH. Dr. Keta came and proved to the whole world that in the Gambian context, there is no underlying case that is linking to female circumcision. Give us the data. Give us the number of deaths. Give us women who had got trial in their maternal birth. All those data are not available, so they cannot blindfold us. We are going to follow our religion teachings and the practice of our cultural norms and value. We will not be dictated by donors, or we will not be dictated by Western propagandas. We are not here to be enslaved as they did in the pre-colonial era.
Imami, the former Prime Minister, Dr. Touré, who is a female, as well as other female in the Gambia who have gone through the process, are saying this is harmful to their health. And why is it that no women are involved in the repeal of this law except all male?
I can ask you to go and check the YouTube of the Gambian Parliament. Before that, it was brought as a matter of the day. All female parliamentarians that are in the parliament supported the ban. They asked and requested. I can even send you evident videos of female parliamentarians for you to see for yourself.
Are you therefore saying that in spite of the failure to succeed in parliament, you will go back to parliament and restart the whole process to repeal it?
I can tell you, Peter, I am a strong man. I am doing for the sake of my people, for the sake of my culture, and for the sake of my religion. We will not be intimidated by Western donors, oppressors. We will not be intimidated by so-called activists whom we know they are circumcised and they have circumcised their daughters. So who are they to come and tell us? If they want to follow money, Let them follow money if they want to follow the dollars and the pounds and the aids. But I can tell you for free, 75 to 80% of Gambians are still willing. And there are processes. A bill that fails in parliament doesn't mean you cannot bring the bill. A bill that fails in parliament, you have other avenues to make sure you pursue this. So our gates are open and we are resilient and we are ever strong and committed in the cause of making sure that we would not have a law that is going to affect 90 to 80% of Gambians, the wish and aspiration. We will not.
Are you saying that a majority of the people of the Gambia will still go against the law and have their girl children circumcised because that is the religious and traditional practices of the people of the Gambia in spite of the law?
I am quoting you sections of the Constitution that have guaranteed that guy in his religious and cultural belief. 25C has guaranteed in their religious practice. 32 has guaranteed for religious culture. And 33 is talking about discrimination. So if any law that is discriminatory, it is non and void in the Constitution and the constitutionality of the country. But we are also saying this. We will not also leave the law to be there. We will pursue in all methods. A bill can be introduced again, or you can restore to courts. So it is left to the Gambians, and the future will tell. Sooner or later, you'll hear that something is going on and it's going to happen. We will not stand back.
Amami Giba is a member of the Gambian Parliament. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In Cameroon, former students of Seka Baptist College in the diaspora plan to hold a four-day convention beginning August 1st in Chicago. The aim of the meeting to be held under the theme Invest in Women and Girls, Accelerate Progress is to help to provide women and girls with the resources and opportunities to reach their full potential. Seka Baptist College in Limbe, Cameroon is a prestigious all-girls Christian boarding secondary school. It was founded by North American Baptists in collaboration with the Cameroon Baptist Convention. Officials of the school say a majority of the teaching staff came from the United States of America. Dr. Joyce Ashutangtang, a poet, actress, interdisciplinary scholar, and professor at the University of Hartford, Connecticut, is the national president of the former Seka Student Association. She talks to me about the plans and prospects of the coming convention.
So this convention is not just a reunion, but an opportunity to fundraise for the projects that support our mission, which is to provide resources and opportunities for women and girls to reach their full potential.
The theme of this convention, I understand, is Invest in Women and Girls, Accelerate Progress. Tell me a little bit about this.
That theme embodies who we are and what we are doing. And what we are trying to do here is to accelerate progress. We have been doing this for 23 years, but we are asking our donors, we are asking our members, to put in more effort. We are living in very dystopian times. We've made so much progress as women, but there's so much more to be done. So we are asking for our donors to support us so we can increase the progress we have made. For example, in Cameroon right now, at Seka Baptist College, we are sponsoring internally displaced girls.
Yes. I was about to ask some of the projects that you are undertaking or why you are undertaking this fundraising activity as part of the convention.
We are women who have been privileged to have education. We have been privileged to have training. And what we want to do is to give back to our community so that more girls can do what we have done and even better. So that is our driving mission, because as you know, it's not just a slogan, it is a reality that you invest in a woman, you invest in a nation.
So Joyce, talk to me about the mentorship program that you have, sanitation and health, and infrastructure. Briefly talk to me about some of these projects.
Let me start with the infrastructure. So Seka Baptist College, when the school was built, the dining facility was meant for 450 students. Now we have a student population of over 1,000, and we are still using the same facility. So this overcrowding is a health hazard. That's our flagship project. We promised the school during our 60th anniversary in 2022 to build that dining facility. And so then we have sanitation and health. The school is perched on a hill. And so it has been a struggle, but fortunately we've been able to dig boreholes. We've been able to provide tanks, even a solar panel to help with the pumping of the water. Now we want to make the water accessible. The school still has the plumbing that was done in 1962 when the school was established. So it is our goal to help change that plumbing so that water can be accessible. One of the things that I want to say is that we are not just focused on the campus. We have been able to make this water accessible to the surrounding community. So we have faucets, you know, outside the campus gate for the community as well. We realized that we had to go beyond the scholarships that we have for students inside Seka Baptist College. We decided to go outside and say, how can we make Seka a dream come true? For those students that Seka Baptist College remained a dream, they don't have the means, they're not even thinking about it. And our first cohort were young girls who are intelligent, but they've been caught up in the crisis that has rocked Cameroon now since 2017, the internally displaced girls. So we had a nationwide search and selected four of them whom we are training in Seka Baptist College for 7 years. They have full scholarship and we take care of them holistically.
For those who will be attending the convention, as the president, what will be the major takeaway of those who will be at this convention?
First of all, I want to say that we are doing something unique this year. We have always had what we call personal professional development. And this year we've elevated that on Saturday morning. So we're going to have panelists. I just talked about careers less traveled. We're going to have people who have done things that are not common. We'll be talking about their careers. We have a comedian from Cameroon who is a male but acts like a female. We'll be talking about that experience. We have an engineer that had to give up engineering and is now an industrialist, food industrialist, who is actually supplying smoked fish for in the United States for the African and Asian community. We have somebody talking about oil and gas, real estate. So we have all these speakers.
Dr. Joyce Ashutangtang, a poet, actress, interdisciplinary scholar, and professor at the University of Hartford, Connecticut, is the national president of the former Seka Student Association. She spoke with me from Connecticut. In Namibia, Menga, a digital health innovation technology product, is scheduled to be launched on August 1st in the capital, Windhoek. The digital health product is expected to assist patients in rural and semi-rural areas to access their prescribed medications without the need for the internet. It comes as health experts are urging countries in Africa to embrace technology to improve healthcare delivery. Dr. Esperance Luvindao is a physician and the founder of Menga. She talks to me about the significance of the digital health platform and its anticipated impact on healthcare delivery across Africa.
Menga is a step into the future of African telemedicine. It is a digital health innovation that I developed that I've been working on the past few years. In summary, what it allows for is for patients in rural, semi-rural areas, even urban areas, to be able to access prescribed medication without having to leave their local areas. This is very important, particularly for people that stay in rural and semi-rural areas, because it reduces the out-of-pocket health costs, allowing patients to access the prescribed medication without leaving their local areas, reducing costs and reducing the burden on local hospitals as well.
What is the significance of this healthcare platform?
When we started my organization, that is in 2019, At first, we were just offering free medical advice. We very quickly realized that it does not solve the problem full circle. So yes, you tell somebody that, okay, fine, you most likely have gonorrhea or you have a tonsillitis, but you're not giving them the medication. So they still have to travel long distances to get the medication. So we weren't solving the problem full circle. So I then went to the drawing board, started approaching, you know, software developers and engineers to see if this was possible. And basically what this allows for is that all these patients, and we see it a lot, particularly in a lot of African countries, where a lot of patients have to literally travel, some even over 100 kilometers just to see a doctor. And when they get to the hospital, they then have to wait sometimes up to 8 hours just to see a doctor to be told, okay, you have an upper respiratory tract infection, here, your meds, go home. And this is what we are trying to combat, because unfortunately, because of the distances from hospitals, quality health care is oftentimes affected. This has the possibility to affect millions, not just looking at Namibia, we're looking at Africa as a whole. And also the important thing that makes this innovation so different is that one can use it without the use of internet. So somebody that stays in a semi-rural area that doesn't have internet can consult their doctor using their little normal phone without any internet, and then still get to access their medication by simply walking, you know, a little short distance to their local supermarket, and then access our innovation and access their medication without having to travel long distances. That is the significance thereof.
After the launch, will there be any education drive to educate these residents in the rural areas about how they can access this platform, like you have explained, even without internet?
100%. And I think it's so important that you ask this. And the reason for that is because technology is advancing at a very rapid pace. However, we must remember to carry the people with us. And so, yes, when you launch something, the people themselves that need it might not know how it works, might not think that, okay, if I just see my doctor do a consultation on my phone, is it really seeing the doctor? Am I really getting the right medication? So, yes, we have the organization under which, which is my organization, under which we're launching this, has over 100 volunteers. And we have a team of volunteers that we are going to dispatch in order to ensure that we start to educate people, not just online, but within the communities of the technology that is to come.
So what do you think are the prospects of this platform, and how do you think state institutions across the continent, you can partner them in order to actualize the objective for which this platform was created?
That is a crucial question. I must be honest that as a young innovator, there has been quite a bit of resistance, because I know particularly within the African, you know, within the African, you know, healthcare sort of sector as a whole, a lot of the times our policies and regulations don't speak to where technology is right now and where technology is going. And so in order for that partnership to be realized internationally with various countries around, it is important that you know, those in leadership, number one, understand the importance of embracing technology in order to offer better health care. And I think the greatest myth is that it costs much more to implement or integrate health care. And that is a myth with technology in healthcare, and that is a myth we are trying to break.
Dr. Esperance Luvindao is a physician and the founder of Menga. She spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. Namibia is one of Africa's top five diamond exporters, right behind Angola, Botswana, and South Africa. In 2022, the country exported more than 940 million worth of diamonds. However, the head of the country's largest marine diamond company is worried about competition from synthetic diamond, a sector of the business that could cost many Namibians their jobs. For VOA, Vitalio Angula reports from the Namibian capital, Windhoek.
The world's demand for natural diamonds has bounced back from a slump during the COVID-19 pandemic, with Namibia's marine diamond mining company, Deb Marine, reporting a sales increase of 83% in 2022 from the previous year. However, the company's CEO, Willie Mertens, is concerned about the rising popularity of lab-grown synthetic diamonds. There's nothing obvious to distinguish artificial diamonds from natural diamonds, though trained jewelers can tell the difference. The Modern Mining publication recently said that in 2022, lab-grown diamond jewelry surpassed 10% of the market of global jewelry sales for the first time. The publication said artificial diamond sales are forecast to continue growing at an annual double-digit percentage rate in coming years. Namibia, where workers extracted 2.1 million carats in diamonds in 2022, is embarking on a campaign to tout natural diamonds as environmentally sound and holding greater value for money.
We've seen in the last couple of years that lab-grown diamonds, or synthetics as you're calling them, have sort of infiltrated the natural diamond market. And that is, that's probably came about, the initial thing was about people were first marketing them as real diamonds. We've done a lot of work around trying to differentiate them.
One of the challenges of marketing Namibian natural diamonds is the environmental impact that diamonds have on the landscape. Martin says Deb Marine invests a significant amount of its profits into environmental rehabilitation and restoration of landscapes and the seabed that has been damaged by mining.
The restoration of the seabed actually happens naturally as the waves move. So what we're doing is we're monitoring that. And what we do is we mine out a specific area and we leave an area next to that vacant, if I can call it like that. And over time, we monitor how the area where we've recovered diamonds looks like compared to the one that was not touched. And we've seen that it takes about 3 to 10 years maximum for that area to completely restore. And completely restore, we mean about 80% of the organisms have returned to that place. On the land, obviously, it's sand that we are moving. And what we do now is we are actually using that same sand to keep the seawalls intact.
Martens recently paid a courtesy call on Namibian President Nangolo Mbumba to introduce the De Beers Global Ambassador for Natural Diamonds, Hollywood actor Lupita Nyong'o, and talk to the president about challenges facing Namibia's diamond industry. President Mbumba lamented a proposal from the Kimberley process, the process meant to screen out so-called conflict diamonds from entering the international market, to begin certifying all diamonds in Antwerp, Belgium. The group of seven largest economies say that is an effort to prevent Russian diamonds from being sold abroad. Mbumba says the measure will hurt African diamond-producing countries.
Recently, a decision was made by the G7 countries to root all rough and polished diamonds destined for G7 countries via Belgium. This decision points a serious risk and threat to our economies, especially the economy of Angola, Botswana, and Namibia, by increasing the cost as well as curtailing the freedom of trade for our country's products.
Namibia's president says he and his counterparts from Angola and Botswana have written a letter to the G7 to ask them to halt their plans. Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Despite the myriad of pressing and acute crises now dominating the African continent, it is time for policymakers and decision makers in Africa to take some time out to ponder what the International Court of Justice a week ago Friday said about the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. The ICJ was responding to a question put to them by the General Assembly and two other, the National Organization for Advisory Opinion, which is one of the functions of the ICJ. In response, the court's ruling was very, very, very firm. And many of those who have been dealing with the Middle East for a long time could easily see why the ruling of the court was as it was. First, the court said what any expert of the Middle East should have known, that the 57 years occupation of a Palestinian land, it is illegal and against international law. That the settlements, Israeli settlements in the West Bank, are also contrary to international law. And the court also said that some of the annexations which have been done by the Israeli government of Palestinian land are also illegal. Now, this advice, your opinion, will be taken up by the General Assembly because they asked for it and they will react to it. We have heard from the Palestinian delegation that shepherded the issue before the ICJ that they will be coming up with a package before the Assembly to get their reaction. Obviously, they would receive gladly the ruling of the ICJ. But what I would like to address today is what the ICJ addressed to all member states. So separate from what the General Assembly or the Security Council might say, the court said that individual states must review their relations with the State of Israel, which was occupying Palestinians against international law. It's illegal. They're also saying that member states should review not just their relations with Israel, but a whole gamut of relationship. And this is where African states have a lot to react to. And in this connection, one has to remember that South Africa during the apartheid period went through the same pain and agony that the Palestinians are going through today. African states have to weigh and think about what should be their relationship with a state that is disobeying international law, destroying the lives of Palestinians in the West Bank because of the settlements. For some time now, there has been a debate when the issue of having Israel as an observer state of the African Union. Now the International Court has rendered a ruling. Is the African Union going to offer an observer status to a country that disregards the national law and also to do what many Africans fought against? The court said that Israel is disallowing the Palestinians from enjoying their independence and states. This is what may be painful. Of course, individual states will have to also examine their relations with Israel. This is separate from the way African states will react to the General Assembly. And of course, you have to remember that members of the African Union include lots and lots of states in the northern part of the continent who feel strongly about the denial of self-determination of the people of Palestine. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Oh my God.
I'll be the girl them zaddy. The girl them zaddy. Can you give me 1 minute attention?
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
And telling me slow progression. Let me watch how I move. Doubting me never go help. Baby, I go need your groove. And I know what you're thinking, so I go try a little harder. All these things that I'm doing, only to get you to love my mother. Hey. So you can bring on your girlfriends, so we party harder. And you can tell them I'm your best friend. Never mind. Jacket, I go walk, walk you to the market. Treat you like a lady, like a lady, like a lady. Oh, I go go river, I go come carry water. I go full up the gen set for the power. Treat you like a lady, like a baby, like a lady. Oh, girl, I don't say you doubt me, so I go try a little harder. All these things I keep doing, only to get you to love my mother. And you can bring all your GS, so we party hard, oh. Or don't make me your BF.
Tonight I'm out here with you, my baby. I love perfect timing, cause when I bless my eyes on you, not to put my mic on you daily. And let the blessings fall on me. I'm in a zone while she whine on me. Hey, give it to me, baby, so slowly. I need tarot.
Too much care, my day. Waka waka wa Sunday, my day.
I'm a rush, you know, was a man, sitaki tena, ili ulikufa. if I can't seem to see that.
To wapwani kwani nini kipita wavutena marashi mahi ni hug a smell of all of me she like it how I ride the beat I whisper loving in her ear slowly journey ku baby mgongoni baby huni potezi girl my baby don't you worry born in my arms and 12 my baby pushes on cause I talk up in that way with every single love in day I'm on my way making sure my level straight and I don't want nobody that's gonna be up in my way. I got my baby, she my baby. Talk up in that way with every single loving day. I'm on my way making sure my level straight and I don't want nobody that's gonna be up in my way. I got my baby, she my baby.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington.
From circle to a jungle, we no stop for it. Circle to a jungle, a mad love be what we get. We the conquered. Mad love as the sunset. I'll be buying you Prada bags and more. Honey, you making sweet macara and cocoa. We for shop some money from the oil and gold. Party with the party so. Oh, so so wine and she come they go. She the wine like she day on top of moto. Pussy's on a boy said, yeah, I'll get some more.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know, by now we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Bob Bars, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a child who seeks wisdom from the elders is wise. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Nobody be moving while you sipping on your lager. I know I'll be blinking, I just want to see you longer. You give me a melody and you're beating longer. To quench my fire within the need the water tanker. So baby, you mean more to me than CDs and Nairas. And if you wear the money, baby, I'll take up the bribe.
Together, together.
See how nice, yes, yes. See how nice,
yes, yes. See you night and look together. See you night and look together.